You know, I'm just old enough to remember a time when people were trying to turn down the levels of hate, not turn them up. The good old days. Hi, everybody. I'm Bill Whittle here with Steve Green and Scott Ott, and this is your Right Angle about some interesting and somewhat disturbing trends, and I think they need to be responded to because silence is what allows these things to continue. Scott, I'd like to start with you. There is a professor of theology, and she has a prayer, which apparently she's caught in a little grief for, which is, of course, racism. But basically, it's a prayer to God, asking her, rather, it's a prayer to God, asking God to help her increase her hate, her hatred of white people. I'll just read a little bit of it here. So here's Shanika Walker Barnes's contribution. It's a prayer called the Prayer of a Weary Black Woman. Dear God, please help me to hate white people, or at least to want to hate them. At least I want to stop caring about them individually and collectively. I want to stop caring about their misguided racist souls and stop believing that they can be better, that they can stop being racist. Now, I don't think this would be much of a story, Scott, if this wasn't a theology professor, but I'll just cut to the chase here. I don't think God works that way.
Yeah, I won't even ask at what school was she professing her theology, but the idea of a prayer of the kind that she suggests, which is kind of personal prayer about, for want of a better term, self-improvement, not meaning that you can improve yourself, but meaning that yourself needs to be improved. Mm-hmm. I always laugh when I go into Christian bookstores and they have a self-improvement section. I'm like, that's not how it works. But anyway, you know, typically you are calling out to the Lord to change me, okay? I am behaving in a way that is no longer in comportment with the person I have become because Jesus has changed me. Jesus has set me free from my sin. Jesus has given me a whole new life. All things have become new. And I want my actual lived out behavioral experience to reflect that internal change that he has executed in me and the presence of the Spirit of God that lives in me because I've come to faith in Christ. So that's like when you're praying, you're like, you're not praying, God, change that other person most of the time, at least not if you have any understanding of the scripture and the real problem with this world, which is me. You're praying, God, change me. Now, if
but that's what she's doing. She's praying doing for God that, to change her into a more hateful person.
I'm getting there.
So, I'm sorry.
So apparently she thinks that one of her chief flaws is that she's extraordinarily gracious and loving and tolerant and forgiving of other people, all of which would be things that normally I would wish to be and aspire to be, but am not. So, you know, my typical prayer would be, Lord, help me to change my attitude toward that person who I'm angry at, or that person who I hate, although that's pretty strong for me. I'm just not that strong in anything. But, you know, that attitude is the reverse of exactly the reverse of what you would expect. What we have here is not a theology professor. What we have here is a person who needs counseling. We have a person who needs to be surrounded by people who love her and that can help walk her through this process of understanding the true nature of God. Because once you've seen Jesus, as it were, face to face, you could never pray that. That would not even enter your mind. I used to say early on, after I came to faith in Christ, that what surprised me most was that I used to have this nasty, filthy mouth. And I had gotten to the point very quickly where if I stubbed my toe in the dark, I would say, ouch. And that change was from within because it was an involuntary response that grew out of something that normally would have caused me to unleash a string of expletives. So this poor person has not had that transformative experience. She may have gone into scholarship, but she's not gone into Jesus. She's not gone into understanding the nature of the living God and how he transforms.
Well, no matter what you might think of his personal flaws, Dr. Martin Luther King was a theology student, and he spent his entire life, which was cut short, trying to reduce the amount of hate out there, not trying to increase it. Steve, I got to tell you, I use that story for warm up for this one. and not for the reasons that people are going to think. Here's another teacher from Barnard College, an English instructor, a young black fellow, who wrote this and actually defended it on the radio. He was talking about the fact that nobody can get along with anybody anymore in America, which is another mystery why this might be. But here's what he said about it. He said, and this is a quote, "When this race war hits its crescendo, I'll gather all of you," meaning white people, "into a beautifully decorated room under the pretense of unity. I'll give a speech to civility and all the good times we share. I'll smile as we raise our glasses to your good white health while the detonator blinks under the table, knowing the exits are locked and the air vents are filled with gas." I'd like to get your take on that before I really launch myself, because this one made me actually pretty angry.
Yeah, that's the only word for that is evil. That's it. To plan the murder of a group of people based solely on their race with the intent of doing that just because is pure evil. Bill, I know we talked about the Holocaust during the backstage segment, so I don't want to step on that part because I think that's going to be your big finish. But I want to mention this part because it's related but a little tangential. When Third Army was liberating Southern Germany from the Nazis, Patton, under Ike's direction, when word of these camps, not the death camps out east, but these labor camps in Western and Southern Germany, Ike wanted all of his generals to see this. I think he wanted all the troops to see this. And in Ike's words, he couldn't always explain what you were fighting for, but at least the soldiers could see what they were fighting against. And these labor camps, again, we're not talking about the places with the gas chambers and the ovens like Auschwitz and Treblinka. We're just talking about the forced labor camps. The people there were so emaciated that it was practically impossible to tell the living from the dead. If somebody still barely living twitched a little, you would say, "Ah, that one is still alive." The filth, the stench, the conditions were so horrendous that Patton, old blood and guts, could not stand to go in to one of these dorms, if you want to call it that, where the living were on some of them on their last moments of life. That's the conditions that the Nazis allowed people to live in. Again, we're not talking about the death camps. This is how they treated the living. And we don't teach these horrors anymore. The last people who saw these things with their own eyes, they're all but dead. We have to teach this stuff, Bill. I don't know if it would stop somebody like the person you were just talking about, whose name I don't even want to mention, but it would build up the resistance we need as a society against these kinds of thoughts, against these kinds of intentions. Because we have seen again and again that the progressive left is essentially totalitarian. They are totalitarian culturally, they are totalitarian politically, and given a chance, I don't doubt for one minute that we would have the kind of conditions in this country that the men of Third Army saw in Germany in 1945.
Well, I'm going to just spend a few moments giving this guy a little bit of history lesson because this is something I happen to know something about. There were 6 extermination camps that were set up by the Nazis during World War II. They were Birkenau, which was basically just off of Auschwitz, Mengenik, Kelmo, which was where they first started using chemicals from a van and putting people in a van and using the exhaust. But the 3 main killing centers outside of Auschwitz were the 3 camps that they put together for Operation Reinhard after Reinhard Heydrich had been killed. And they were Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. And the one that I know the most about is Treblinka. So let me tell you a little bit about what life was like in Treblinka. A train carrying 60 cars with 200-300 people in a car, somewhere around 200, something like that, would pull into the Treblinka train section, just a little spur off the side of the road. And on a very busy day, there would be 6 trains, normally 2 or 3. Each one of these trains had 60 cars, and 20 cars at a time would be backed up into the end of the spur. There was nothing beyond that on the track because there's nothing beyond that for the people who were getting out of the train. They would get out of the train onto a warehouse that was filled with human hair and human clothes that was designed to look like a train station with a, here's a train manager thing and here's a restroom, all of them fake doors. There was a fake clock painted on the wall. It's perpetually 6 o'clock at Treblinka. And when the people would get off of the carts, 20 railroad cattle cars at a time, they would go down a ramp. They would be forced into a small enclosure. And all of Treblinka, all of it, the entire killing section of Treblinka was about 400 yards by 700 yards wide. It is smaller than a typical highway interchange. And they killed 850,000 people in this place. Once they got into this initial sorting area, the women and the children were sent off into a barracks. The men had to strip naked on one side. The women had to take off all their clothes. And as they continue on, their cavity searched and then their hair is shaven off because the hair is used to make special slippers for the guys in the U-boats. The women were then sent down a long tube. It was about 2 meters wide. It was covered with barbed wire, but it was completely fenced in with like fir tree branches, so it looked like a hedge. And they'd be kicked, spiked, tortured, bayoneted all the way down. And they come around the corner. There's a gigantic building with a Star of David. Two doors open up. They go inside. They see a hallway. And inside the hallway, there are 5 steel doors. One by one, they'd open the steel doors and they'd put 200-300 people in each one of these chambers. The floors of the chambers slanted outwards a little bit. And the reason that they slanted outwards was because it was easier to hose the blood off of them that way and they could move people through them faster with a sloping floor. Once every one of these 10 gas chambers had been filled up with people, the doors were completely locked and they would turn on a diesel generator that they'd taken from a Soviet tank and they'd pump carbon monoxide gas into these chambers for about 25 minutes or so. Longer sometimes, depending on the weather and so on. And after that was over, they let 10 minutes go by. And then from the outside, they would open these gigantic garage-type doors. And instead of bodies falling out, the bodies just simply stood there because the people had been packed in so tightly together that they were simply a mass of flesh. They'd urinated on themselves, defecated on themselves, blood coming out of their nose, coming out of their ears. And guys had to go in and sometimes with crowbars had to peel these people out of this room, put them on a little sort of a trolley and run them over to a ditch, dump them into the ditch. Meanwhile, back at the train station, you've got an entire group of other people who are cleaning up all of the refuge and all of the debris because we got another 20 trains coming through in about half an hour, another 20 cars. Then, after the Soviets beat the Germans in at Stalingrad, and it began to look like the Germans might lose the war, Himmler comes down to Treblinka to visit, and he realizes, my God, there's evidence here of us committing a major crime. So with the 300,000 or 400,000 dead bodies in the ground, Himmler brings in these giant excavators and tells the Jewish slave workers, who will work for a few extra days before they're killed, that they have to disinter 200, 300,000 bodies, pick them up and put them into these burning pits, which burn for 24 hours a day. You put the women on the bottom because women have a little more body fat. They burn more easily than the men do. That's what they found. They found that if you put people on a grill, like with railway lines, they would burn much, much better. And the SS used to throw babies into the fire while they were still alive just to see the reaction of the parents. And late at night, especially when it got a little cooler, they were known to take their chairs and sit upwind of these fire pits and warm their hands by this volcano of burning people. And this is what happened in one day at Treblinka. And Treblinka was open for 13 months. So I don't want to hear anybody ever call me a Nazi or anybody else a Nazi again. And I want anybody to joke about gas chambers again, not because of this idiot. This idiot didn't hurt my feelings. Doesn't hurt my feelings. This guy say, well, we want to gas all white people. I don't give a damn about what this guy says. But I am not going to, I'm going to do my bit anyway to make sure that the language does not degrade to the point so that we equate somebody who wants small government with the same kind of people that used to literally now without the slightest bit of exaggeration, in order to terrorize the women, they would take babies. This big, strong SS guy would pick them up by the feet and just rip them in half. Now, if you think that having a different opinion from you is the same thing as what these people did, and we all need to go to gas chambers, then I have some history lessons for you to take in. And while I'm on this roll, let me just conclude with this. Schindler's List is an amazing movie about the Holocaust, and it shows to a great deal just how brutal the Nazis, especially the SS, were to the Jews. But Schindler's List, to my astonishment, because I wanted to be Steven Spielberg for 10 years, Schindler's List has the biggest cop-out in the history of cinema. And I'm going to tell you why. In that movie, all these women that we've gotten to know during the course of this film are accidentally shunted off to Auschwitz. They're not supposed to be there. They're supposed to go to Schindler's factory, but they go to Auschwitz. And so at Auschwitz, they have their heads shaved and they're packed into the gas chambers and the steel doors close. And all of a sudden, instead of the gas, out of the shower heads comes water because it was all a mistake. They weren't supposed to be there. I guess the governor called at the last minute and decided to commute the sentence. And the reason that's the biggest cop-out in cinema history is because that never, ever, ever happened. The cavalry never came over the hill. The phone never rang. Nobody ever decided to have some mercy. There wasn't a moment when, hey, you know what? The machines aren't working. If the gas machines aren't working, then we just leave them in there overnight. It is insane to me that he would not only not show what actually happened, that was the entire reason for Schindler's List, but that he would give us this sugar-coated, oh, look, water is coming out of the shower curtains. I mean, out of the shower heads. Those things weren't designed for water. They were designed to disperse gas. They were looking like shower heads because they didn't want people to panic so they could tightly pack more of them in there. This kind of thing has got to stop. And it's got to stop. And the only way to stop is for people to tell stories in such a way so that they understand what actually happened inside of the gas chambers at Auschwitz. You can see on reinforced concrete walls, poured concrete walls, you can see fingernails in the sides of these concrete walls from people that are trying to climb above this gas. So when I hear somebody like this talk about gassing white people, it's not a question of gassing white people. I'd have this exact same reaction if it was somebody white talking about gassing black people. This kind of thing has got to stop. And the way it stops is for people like this to be shamed into the realization that by making a statement like that, they have essentially lessened the suffering of people who went through these actual things and turned it into kind of a rhetorical device. It's not a rhetorical device for the hundreds of thousands of people who died. It's not a rhetorical device for the 10,000s of women who had their children smashed against the walls and just splattered there by SS guys as they poked them into a gas chamber. And I'm not going to let that get by without some kind of response, you miserable, low-life, idiotic, stupid man. And all the rest of you, too. Yeah, I hope that'll cheer you up for the weekend. But nevertheless, these things have to be said, and they have to be said in this fashion. You got to get angry about these things because these are the things, among all the other things that have ever happened on this earth, there's anything that deserves to be getting angry about, it's putting people into gas chambers and doing it as you're running a factory. 7,000 people today, 10,000, 12,000. Oh, slow day. Really? Only one train today only killed 2,000 people today and threw their bodies into burning pit of fire and then sat up, put our feet up and drank some schnapps and sang some old songs. I'm Bill Whittle, and this is Steve Green and Scott Ott. We'll see you next week right here on Right Angle.